Okay, well, welcome back, everybody. It's looks like pretty much you're all here and settled in again for our talk tonight. So I think most of you know that this year we're studying the Four Noble Truths. Maybe people that are here for the first time, you might not know that, but most of you have been here for a while and you know that. And this month our theme is the Fourth Noble Truth, the Eightfold Path. So last week, if you were here, Tuari gave a really wonderful talk introducing this topic. And tonight I'm going to continue with this kind of introduction mode to the Fourth Noble Truth. And so some of what I'll be going over is probably pretty similar to what Tuari talked about. So there may be some repetition, but some things will be a little bit different. And even if we talk about the same things, we talk about them in slightly different ways. So hopefully it won't be too much of the same thing. And it doesn't ever hurt to hear things over and over and over, especially in the Dharma. It seems like, hear it one time, don't really get it. Hear the second time, maybe. Finally, like maybe the 10th time, or sometimes I feel like the 100th time. Oh, now I see what they're talking about. So it doesn't hurt to hear things more than once. So far this year, we've covered the first, second, and third noble truths. And these truths really lay out some of the really important understandings that we need to come to if we want to realize the Buddha's promise of liberation. So first, we need to understand suffering or dukkha. Then we need to understand the cause, that the cause of our suffering or dukkha is craving, and to abandon that craving. And then we need to understand the cessation of suffering, that it's really possible, and then to actually experience this cessation or end of suffering for ourselves, even if it's only temporary, even if it just lasts for a moment or a day, to know that it's possible. So the Fourth Noble Truth lays out the path that we follow. To actually understand and realize these noble truths. So it kind of describes the things that we need to do to really follow this path and reach the end of this path for ourselves. So, in other words, if the first three noble truths tell us what we need to know, the fourth noble truth, this truth of the Eightfold Path, tells us what we need to do to get to that place of knowing these things. And sometimes the Eightfold Path is talked about as a path of purification, because as we work with the different aspects of the Eightfold Path, we gradually purify our understanding of the Dhamma. We gradually purify our minds of greed and hatred and delusion, and we gradually purify our conduct of all those kinds of not very helpful, not very pleasant actions that come from those times when we get caught up in these painful mind states of greed and hatred. And so, with the other truths, for all the other truths so far, there have been three insights associated with each of those truths. And the same thing is true for the Eightfold Path. So, for the first one of these for the Eightfold Path is, what is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering? So the first thing is actually knowing that there is a path and having some idea of what this path is about. And Tuari went over that last week, talked about the different elements of the path, and I'm going to go over it too now as kind of a review to make sure everybody remembers and knows and we're all kind of on the same page. So the Noble Eightfold Path has eight different elements, and Tori went over those also. And as she said, they're often described as right or sometimes as wise. And the Pali word for this is sama. And Tori mentioned that there was another possible translation in addition to right and wise, which is harmonious, which kind of gives this sense of, you know, harmony and everything working together with these elements of the Eightfold Path. And then in our Sunday planning meeting that the teachers for the Sunday sit have, Carrie Peterson joined us, and she shared another translation that I really liked, and so I wanted to share with you, and that is attuned. And, you know, it would sound kind of weird in English to talk about attuned view or attuned conduct. It doesn't quite really fit with the way that we talk, but it still has a really, for me, it has a really nice sense about it because it makes me think of what's right or wise is attuned. You know, it's attuned with the truth. It's attuned with kindness and non-harming. And it's attuned with what is needed in the present moment. So that might be also a nice way to think about these elements. You know, they're correct, they're correct or right, they're wise, they're harmonious, they're attuned. There are different ways you can, different words, and maybe one will be just the right word for you. So as Tori described last week, these eight elements deal with three main aspects of our lives and our meditation practice: wisdom, conduct, and mental development or meditation. And so I'm going to go over these again. First, there's the wisdom aspect, which includes right or wise view. And so basically, this is understanding the noble truths. So it's understanding suffering as well as the two other of the three characteristics, impermanence or anicca and not self or anatta, really understanding the truth of the way things are, understanding that the cause of suffering is craving and that abandoning craving will relieve our suffering. And then also understanding and really experiencing for ourselves that relief or cessation of suffering. And wise view also includes some understanding of karma. And this is in, you know, in the sense that our actions have consequences. And wise actions lead to happiness, and unwise actions lead to not so much happiness. So it isn't really sort of the sense that we're punished exactly for bad behavior. Not so much that exactly, but more in the sense there just isn't any way that being lost in hatred and greed and delusion and doing all kinds of actions that come out of those kind of mind states are ever going to bring us any kind of lasting happiness or are ever going to make people around us feel very happy either. So it's sort of kind of a sense that it actually makes sense to behave in ways that are kind and good and wise, and it will have a good result, even though it might not unfold the way we think it ought to, even though sometimes it seems like there's plenty of people that are doing plenty of evil things and they seem to be getting along pretty darn well. Well, ultimately, that will not be so. And then there is right or wise intention, which means approaching our life and our practice with the intentions of protecting life, the intentions of loving kindness, the intentions of generosity. So, you know, freedom from ill will, renunciation. So our practice is really directed more and more towards these beautiful qualities of kindness, generosity, non-harming, and less trapped in greed and hatred. And then there's the conduct aspect, which I think a lot of us are familiar with. We've, you know, worked with precepts and everything. So there's wise speech. So we train ourselves to speak the truth, be honest, and also to avoid gossip, harsh speech, speech that's not appropriate for the time. Right action, where we train in not just wise speech, but the other precepts too. Not destroying life, not stealing or taking what's not given, not getting involved with sexual misconduct that hurts us and hurts other people, not getting our minds all clouded and confused with intoxicants, and then right livelihood, you know, finding an occupation and a way to make our living that really brings benefit to ourselves and others and doesn't harm us or others. And then finally, there's the mental development or meditation aspect. So first, there's right or wise effort. And, you know, I feel like with especially this aspect of the Eightfold Path, wise really fits better than right, because there's such a variety of different ways that may be appropriate depending on the situation. So right or wise effort. Now, one of the definitions of right effort is encouraging and cultivating wholesome mind states and in discouraging the unwholesome ones. And I think as a broad aim, that actually really makes sense. That's the direction that we want to go. But it's easy to interpret misinterpret those kinds of words and get the idea that what we're being told to do is making good things happen and getting rid of all the bad things. So it's just, you know, kind of very fixing mindset. And often that really isn't the kind of effort that's needed. More often it's really the effort to just be present, to see clearly and understand whatever it is that's arising in the mind. And when we do that and don't get entangled in the difficult states, but just really see them as they are, then that cultivation of wholesome mind states and discouraging of unwholesome mind states just kind of happens naturally. We don't have to go in there and try to get rid of this and make this happen. And there's much more about this topic. I could, you know, we'll have a whole month to talk about it, but this just gives a little bit of a sense of it. Then there's right or wise mindfulness. So this is developing the ability to be aware and attentive in the present moment and to really skillfully observe what's arising in our minds and bodies. And Philip Moffat, in his book on the Four Noble Truths, Dancing with Life, he reminds us that wise mindfulness isn't just paying attention, but actually really investigating and what's going on and experiencing it fully so we can really understand it. And exactly how this mindfulness appears, plays out for us, you know, can depend, be a little bit different depending on the situation that we're in. You know, when we're on retreat, our mindfulness might be, you know, very deep and focused. So, you know, we're going in and knowing and feeling and seeing every little thing in great detail, like if we have a ache in the body, seeing all the tiny elements of the pulsing and the stinging and the burning and the stopping of that, and just, you know, really great detail into everything. But in daily life, where we're, you know, doing all sorts of different things, it might be very different from that. maybe we will just have a kind of a light attention to our body to kind of keep us more in the present moment and not too lost. Or maybe checking in every now and then just to notice our state of mind and see if, you know, we're feeling some craving there, some aversion, some frustration, or whatever kinds of things like that that might be coming up. And if we are noticing it, taking a minute to pause and be aware, and so we don't just automatically act out of this kind of feeling of irritation or frustration or whatever it is and do things and say things that we might not be so glad that we did or said later. So it can, you know, manifest in different ways depending on our situation. And finally, there is wise concentration. So the concentration part is really developing the steadiness of mind, the collectedness of mind, so we are actually able to pay attention to the things that are going on in our body and mind and see them the way they are. And there are two main ways that we develop this kind of concentration, and this is something also that Philip Moffat talks about a little bit in his book. I really recommend that book. It's a great one to read about the Four Noble Truths. There's what he calls open field attention, or it's also sometimes called momentary concentration. And in this kind of concentration, we have steady attention on different changing objects. So it's sort of the changing sensations in our bodies, the changing emotions that we might have, the changing thoughts we have. It's sort of paying steady attention to all of those, you know, four foundations of mindfulness that we learn about. So this is, you know, really kind of describes Vipassana practice. And then we can also develop concentration by staying steady on a single object, like the breath maybe. And I think what we often do in this tradition is we'll start with the single object like the breath, just work with that one object, bringing the mind back, and until we get a certain level of steadiness and stability, and then we shift to this more open field concentration or momentary concentration, where we're looking at all whatever objects arise, so we have this steady concentration on changing objects. So, but it's also possible to just stay with that single object and keep staying with it and staying with it and staying with it, and develop deep concentration or absorption. And that can be a helpful thing to do. We don't emphasize it so much in our teachings at SIMS, but it can be helpful for some people in some situations, like a retreat situation. So that's, you know, another thing to think about. And then, of course, in our daily life, wise concentration might be quite different from either of these. It might be more like trying to avoid multitasking and actually just paying attention to what we're doing it while we're doing it. That might be the wisest concentration for daily life. So the main point is that there are different ways that it shows up depending on your situation, depending, you know, on your own particular turn of mind. And this also is something we'll have a whole month to work on this. So this is just kind of getting started, so you know that these things are there. So we have a sense of these elements of the Eightfold Path. Last week from Tweri, this week from me, you gotta probably have a pretty good sense of them by now. So we'll go on to the second insight. And the second insight is that this noble truth must be penetrated by cultivating the path. And so it's about, you know, the same thing as with the first three noble truths. It's not enough just to hear about it. It's not enough to have some intellectual understanding of what it includes. It's not just like a set of beliefs or a set of rules or a philosophy or some ideas. We actually have to work with the elements of the Eightfold Path and really work with them in our lives, so we really know all about them through our own direct experience. And so when it comes to wise view and wise intention, you know, it means really reflecting on what we actually understand about the first three noble truths, about suffering, about how we contribute to bringing about that suffering ourselves, how we can find release, and, you know, really working with it the way we have been working over this past 3 months with each of those three noble truths. And with wise intention, it means really being honest with ourselves about our intentions in practice and seeing, you know, are we really directing ourselves toward greater kindness, less greed, less harm, less delusion? Or maybe is our intention more like to have certain experiences in practice or accomplish something? So, you know, we can explore that. When it comes to conduct, we can really pay attention to how we feel when we do certain actions, when we, you know, maybe hurt other people, or when we do things that hurt ourselves, when we're not honest, if we're kind of yell or scream or speak harshly to somebody, when we get mixed up in some kind of sexual thing that isn't necessarily so good, or, you know, when we kind of go off and drink too much or whatever, all those kind of things. You know, really notice how that makes us feel. So it's not like a matter of just following rules. We don't do it because it says we're not supposed to, but more, you know, we don't do it because we really see that it hurts us, that it hurts other people, you know. So understanding what kinds of behavior really contributes to our happiness and what doesn't, based on our own experience. And similarly in our livelihood, you know, we're thinking about ways to behave in our workplace that are really consistent with these values of kindness and honesty and non-harming. And then with the mental development or meditation, we develop a consistent practice. So we have that steadiness and stability of mind, so we can really look at what we're doing, look at what's going on, and understand the truth. And ideally, this should include not just what we do in our formal practice on the cushion, but also things we can do to help us be mindful and aware in our daily activities. So we need to work on each of these elements in a really integrated way. And as we do this, the different ones, they all support each other. They strengthen each other. And so, you know, working on our conduct, we understand more about wise view. Working on our conduct, maybe we have more calm in meditation, and so on and so forth. They work together. And so we'll talk more over the coming year about different ways to practice with each of these elements, but today I'd like to offer a few general practice suggestions that really sort of apply to just this whole way of approaching the Eightfold Path. For you to think about as we start this exploration. So first, it's really good to recognize that this Eightfold Path is not just this, you know, quickie one and done or eight and done, you know. It's not something that you get through boom, 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 boom. It's really a lifetime project, or multiple lifetimes even, maybe. And it's a whole life project. So it involves all aspects of our lives, our meditation practice and everything we do with our friends, family, work colleagues, the whole thing. So it really kind of defines the way that we approach our life. And it takes time to really understand and work skillfully with these different elements. So, you know, it's something we need to be patient about. And considering that this is such a long-term project, it's also really important to have a good support network for ourselves so we can keep going with this when we get discouraged or bored or, you know, as we're going to do. We're going to do. And, of course, you know, having a consistent practice, daily practice, is a good thing. Having some self-discipline is a good thing, but our own discipline and determination aren't always really enough to give us the support we need. So it really helps to have a connection with the Sangha, like our Sangha here at Sims, you know, a place to go to practice, other people to practice with who can encourage you and share their struggles with you. And it also helps to have a connection with one or more teachers, you know, like maybe connection with our guiding teachers, Tim and Tweri and Carrie, you know, being able to consistently listen to them, go on retreat with them, maybe meet with them from time to time to talk about your practice so they understand your practice and really can guide you. That is a big help, too. I know it really helped me a lot to have a consistent relationship with our founding teacher, Rodney, as well as a couple of other teachers I've been practicing with a long time. It really helps to know that these people are there and you keep coming back to them. So, yeah, having a connection with the teacher. And, you know, like, say, if you have problems maintaining your sitting practice, it helps to join, you know, maybe join an online group so you have somebody else to sit with regularly. Taking time to go on retreat is a good thing. So everybody's structure is going to be a little bit different, but it's important to have some structure and support in place for you so you have people to share with, people to help you, a place to go for consistency so you can keep practicing. Another thing that's really important is to know that this path isn't sequential. We don't have to perfect one step before we move on to the next step. So we don't have to develop perfect wisdom and then move on and develop perfect conduct and then move on and start our meditation practice and perfect that. I mean, if that was what we had to do, we better just give up. I mean, no one would be able to get anywhere. It just wouldn't be possible to do that. I mean, there's no way we can really develop wisdom and understanding without working with our conduct, without the insights we get from meditation. We wouldn't get there, you know. So we have to be working with the other areas too. But it's still true that, you know, the Eightfold Path starts with right view and right intention. And so when we begin our practice, I mean, we're not going to really have either of these. Not really. We don't understand enough yet to actually have them. But I think at the same time, as Tweri kind of mentioned before, that to begin our practice, we need at least a little bit of wisdom. We have to know enough to recognize that our life isn't exactly the way we would like it to be. It isn't quite satisfactory as it is. And we need to have a sense that these practices might actually help us, maybe to find some peace or some happiness. So we need to have that much. If we don't have that kind of sense that
we need to do something and this might help, we're never going to even start. So we need that little bit of wisdom to start. Developing true wisdom really, of course, takes a lot more work and goes a lot deeper, but we have to have some sense that our life isn't quite right and this is worth trying. And also it's true that, well, we need to develop a really integrated practice that encompasses all of these parts of the Eightfold Path. When we first begin our practice, a lot of times it's not very integrated and we start with one thing. Now, some people might start with the wisdom aspect by studying the teachings of the Buddha, but not actually practicing them. Maybe somebody else might be inspired by the Buddha's emphasis on non-harming, and so they start out that way, you know, with a really strong sense of wanting to protect life. And I think that here in the West, a lot of us start our meditation practice with the meditation aspect. Now, initially, we might not even have heard of wise view or wise intention or really have a lot of sense of what those even are. And as for conduct, well, I think there's often a way that we feel like, well, we already kind of know about that, you know. If we're brought up in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we all know about the Ten Commandments. We all know you're supposed to love your neighbor. You know, we've heard this. Okay, we know, we know. I mean, we might be very, very far from actually applying these teachings, but we've heard all this stuff. If we're, you know, with other major religions, we've heard something similar. So we're like, yeah. Not so interesting. But meditation is something that's a little bit, you know, different and out there and maybe interesting, you know. So, okay, we're going to start there. And this was definitely the case for me in my practice. I started my practice with meditation. When I began, it's not like I was going through any deep suffering, but I did have the sense that my life wasn't quite satisfactory. I knew a little bit about Buddhism from reading, but not any really deep understanding at all. I was curious about meditation. And so with just that little bit of wisdom to be willing to try, I went on a meditation retreat. And at the time, I really didn't understand what I was getting into. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I was, you know, I was there. I was doing it, my sitting and walking and so on and so forth. And it turned out to be a really transformative experience. And I knew there was really something special that I got from that retreat environment, and I wanted more of it. And so at the beginning there, that's what I thought practice was about, you know, getting more of that good and peaceful feeling that I experienced on my first retreat. So that was my goal. But of course, as you guys probably all know from having some experience with meditation, it wasn't very long before I started to realize that it just wasn't that simple. That peaceful or blissful state that I wanted to have was often quite elusive. And when it did come, it didn't always last very long. You know, I might have a wonderful sit, and then the next time, oh, knee pain, back pain, miserable, terrible, you know. Or maybe I'd keep falling asleep, or my mind would be just restless, and then everything would be beautiful, and then, you know, I had thought that if I just did everything right, I'd have a good meditation, but after a while, I realized that just wasn't the case, and I didn't have that kind of control over anything. And I also began to see how out of control my mind really was. You know, all the weird things that arise in the mind. Some memory from the past, some mental image, all kinds of strange stuff, you know. And then that stuff would be gone and something else would arise, you know, just very chaotic to the point where I would go, well, what is this thing anyway? And where am I in all this mess, you know? And then I also noticed that problems in my everyday life would come up during meditation. And at first, my interpretation of that was, oh, okay, well, here's something I need to change. Here's something I need to fix. Here's something I thought I was okay with, but now I see I'm not. I really got to change this. I really got to fix this. And, you know, in some cases, there was some changing and fixing to be done, but it really took me a little longer to realize that it wasn't always changing and fixing. A lot of times what I really needed to change was not that situation, but more my attitude towards that situation. But it took a while for me to realize that. But at least, you know, it was a beginning of investigating my own suffering, a beginning of moving towards having more of an intention of non-harm towards myself and others, you know, seeing that maybe it would be good to pay a little bit more attention to my conduct and my actions so I wouldn't cause so much pain for myself and other people. And this was all good, but I think what it really took to change things around for me was after meditating for, you know, a few years, I had a pretty strong and rather unsettling experience of not self or anatta in my meditation practice. And when that happened, it really kind of shook me up enough so I realized that no, you know, my practice isn't about getting to this peaceful place. It's about understanding this stuff, these three characteristics, you know, suffering, impermanence, not self. And I saw that those Four Noble Truths that the teachers were always talking about, and I kind of listened and said, yeah, 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 but half of it went it really was what practice was about. And that really changed my way of approaching practice and put my understanding much more in alignment with right view and right intention, although there was much that I still didn't understand. At least I was kind of heading in the right direction. And I expect that some of you may have had this kind of experience. And this kind of experience would probably happen if you begin at a different part of the path. If you started with studying the teachings in the wisdom aspect, eventually I suspect you'd come to a point where you'd realize that, hey, I got a lot of information here, but I really don't know what all of this is about. I need to start practicing. Or if we started by working on our conduct and being kind and non-harming, we might find that we get pretty rigid and very judgmental of ourselves and also of other people who maybe aren't behaving the way that we feel like they ought to. And we might find, too, that as much as we want to have wonderful conduct, it's really hard to do because we don't really have the support of our meditation practice or the support of our wisdom to help us to actually do that. You know, we're trying to do everything just with our own individual effort, and that doesn't always work so well. So if we come from that place, we might start thinking, maybe I have to do other aspects of the practice too and understand more about this. So in a way, you know, this Eightfold Path, this practice with the Eightfold Path, it has its own kind of self-correcting quality. If we're really willing to pay attention and reflect on what's happening as we practice and notice when we find ourselves in difficulty. And in fact, as Tweri talked about a little bit last week, finding ourselves in difficulty is a lot of times a good way to recognize that our practice is a little bit out of balance and maybe we have to look at things a little bit differently or work a little bit more in another area. When we find that we're frustrated or confused or suffering, most of the time there's something there that we're not recognizing. There's some delusion there. There's something we're not paying attention to that we ought to be paying attention to. So if we notice when this is happening and take some time to think about it, maybe get some advice from our teachers, instead of just saying, oh, well, not working, then we see what's going on and we make that correction that we need and our practice grows stronger. So a final piece of advice I'd like to offer is that it really helps to keep in mind some of Philip Moffat's teachings, that we practice practice, we don't practice results. And I think what you may already have found, and if you haven't found it out yet, you will find it out, that as we work with the Eightfold Path, if we have this very goal-oriented mindset where we think we're going to make this happen and then we're going to make that happen and we're going to track our progress and we're going to get to this goal that we have, it's not really going to help us. It's not going to really work for us very well. Partly this is because we can't really control our progress, and I think a lot of times we don't even really necessarily know what progress is. We might think we're not making any progress at all, when actually a lot of stuff is bubbling inside and we're coming to new understandings. We might think we're making tons of progress when really we're just off there, you know, chasing some good feeling. So we may not even know. So as Philip Moffat says, we should practice practice, not results. You know, another thing to remember too is when we get caught up in this goal-oriented mind state and our practice is about achieving, we get into this situation where our practice is all about us. So instead of becoming less identified and attached to self, we build a whole new self around this idea of me as this really good meditator. And that isn't helpful. You know, we sort of go in the opposite direction of the direction we would like to go. So, practice, practice. Don't practice results. Instead of looking towards, you know, the future and all the things we're trying to accomplish, we need to be with whatever is going on in the moment and work with that to the best of our ability. And if we have that kind of right orientation towards kindness, towards generosity, towards non-harming, and we practice as best as we are able with each situation that comes up in our sitting practice, in our interactions with our neighbors, whatever, then our progress will take care of itself and we don't really have to worry about how we're doing or if we're making progress. So this brings us to the third insight, that the noble truth has been penetrated by cultivating the path. So this is that part where we come to where we actually know what we know. And in a lot of ways, this knowing what we know for the fourth noble truth is pretty similar to the knowing that we know for the third noble truth, the truth of the cessation of suffering. And I suspect, certainly I, and probably few of us can really say, like the Buddha said after his awakening, that what needed to be done has been done. finished, complete. You know, I mean, I know that I do not feel that way. My understanding, my conduct, my mental development is not yet perfected. It's not yet complete. My path isn't finished. And you probably feel the same. But at the same time, we've all heard about the path. We've worked with the elements of the path in our daily lives, in our meditation practice. And so we do know something about this path. And we've seen for ourselves that it does lead to the end of suffering because we've really experienced the end of suffering for ourselves. Not completely, not as deeply as we might experience it, but we've experienced enough to know that we can find relief, even if it's only temporary. And we've experienced enough to know that this works and this is the way. So we have, you know, faith. We have verified faith from our own experience. And so, you know, we continue. We know enough to continue. So as we prepare to spend the rest of the year working with these different elements of the Eightfold Path, this first month might be a good idea to just reflect on where we are right now and our relationship with it. When it comes to wise view, maybe we can ask ourselves, what do I feel like I really understand about the first three noble truths, about the three characteristics? You know, are these mostly ideas, or do I actually have some understanding from my own experience? Which parts am I confused about or doubtful about? With wise intention, we might ask ourselves, what intention do I bring to my practice? Am I really looking to be more and more free from hatred and greed and delusion? And to live with more kindness and generosity and less harm? Or am I more kind of looking for a pleasant experience? You know, maybe not connecting with the deeper meaning of the practice. With conduct, we might ask ourselves, you know, what's our attitude about wise action, wise speech, wise livelihood? Are we trying to live up to these suggestions for conduct because we really understand that they lead to happiness? Or is it more just following the rules? Are we struggling with certain parts of this? Are we finding ourselves kind of wanting to rebel, you know? What's our relationship with it? And with the mental development or the meditation aspects, we might ask ourselves if we understand, you know, what is wise effort or wise mindfulness and wise concentration, and how to apply them in our own meditation practice. Do we understand how we can apply those in our everyday life? Which areas maybe need a little bit more study and work? So as you approach these reflections, I advise you, you know, don't think about them as this sort of inventory of all the things that you're doing wrong in your practice and that you have to fix. Don't think about it like that. But think about it more, you know, as noticing the areas that you're curious about or feel confused about, or you feel like you ought to know, would like to know more about, or areas where maybe you kind of feel out of balance, maybe noticing what really excites and motivates you. So it's sort of not a, oh, I'm so bad at this and I have to be better, but more just kind of taking a reflective look and noticing, you know, what are good areas for me to think about, learn more about, what excites me. So these coming months are really an invitation to make this Eightfold Path really alive for you and to make it your own path. So may we do that. And now we have some time for questions, comments. And if you're willing, I would, you know, encourage and welcome you to share your thoughts about your relationship with the Eightfold Path. If you feel like you're ready to do that, you might still be thinking and figuring that out. So here is some time for that. I might mention that for myself, one of the things that's come to mind for me that in the times we're living in, I'm going to really need to work on wise speech because it's very easy to get upset and say things that aren't so wise, and also staying aligned with wise intention of kindness and non-harming. It's so easy to get caught up in anger, and I think it's going to be challenging to work with that this year. And then my other thing is recognizing it's been a while since I've been on retreat, and I really want to devote some more time to deeper practice, so I've set aside some time for that. So others, you know, I welcome you to share your thoughts, or if you have questions, please. I think that there's a microphone, right? That people come, yeah. Yeah, okay. Yes.
Hello. So for me, I've kind of interpreted Buddhism as like this path to like the end of like rebirth, you know? Like there's actions that lead to positive becomings, there's actions that lead to negative becomings, and then there's the path which leads to the end of becoming. And the term that I always find when I ask the question, like, how does this becoming happen? You know, how do we become? How do we break the cycle? Is the term I always come across is dependent origination. And so, like, I just wanted to better understand, like, what is dependent origination? And how do you break it, I guess?
So, yeah. This would be a whole huge, but just really briefly, yeah, this is a really important understanding of dependent origination. And we did have a whole year about it a while back. Typically the place, one of the breaking points is the point where we are confronted with an object, you know, and whatever it is that is we're aware of, we react to it with it's neutral, pleasant, or painful. And so one of the breaking places is that if we can just stay with that place, so we're just knowing the neutral or the pleasant or the painful, the feeling tone of that object, then we're not creating, there isn't the becoming. There isn't, you know, the new self. But if we move on from there and we start wanting or not wanting, the craving gets in there and then the identification gets in there. So it's not just that we want or don't want, we kind of have this idea of, I'm a person that does not like this thing. And we get identified with that. And when that happens, then there's this whole new cycle of becoming. So that's one of the places in the cycle where there's this breaking. So just in a very quick, there's a lot more to be said and studied about that, but that's just a quick answer. Mm-hmm. Welcome. Yes?
Hi. I don't really have a question. I just have a comment because.
That's perfect.
Okay. I really appreciate that you brought up the scenario of when you are getting into practice, you start off having these really great experiences, and then they kind of can go in reverse, and you realize like meditation isn't always going to be this feel-good experience. And I really appreciate that you said that because that happened to me just this past week. I went to the 2-day-long events last weekend that Tueri put on. And a few days before that, I don't know what happened, but I somehow strained my neck, and it resulted in like horrible tension headaches that lasted for like several days. And so I went to meditation, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna relax, and I'm gonna feel better after doing the 2-day-long meditations, even though I know I had already signed up anyway, and I know that's not like the reason we meditate. But I didn't feel better, and then Monday and Tuesday after that happened, like the headaches were actually worse, and so I really got discouraged. I was like, oh gosh, I've been meditating for a year, and you know, it doesn't work, you know.
Yeah.
Even though, like, I knew that that's not why we meditate, and that's not why I meditate, but I still had this just, like, profound sense of, like, serious discouragement, because, like, the 2 or 3 day-longs that I've been to, I've just come out of it feeling, like, extremely relaxed. So I was just kind of like, why didn't that happen? You know, I actually feel worse. So I don't know. It was just kind of like that sense of like knowing that that's not what meditation is for, but also kind of feeling like, oh, why didn't yeah. I get that? So I appreciate that you brought that up. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I really appreciate your sharing that with us. I think that is such a universal experience that we all have. We just have this idea we're going to go into it and we'll do this or that, and we'll have this predictable, really nice experience. And then it doesn't work that way. And I think something that's really funny is that I've heard many stories and I've experienced this for myself is that, you know, when you're like, oh, this is so nice, blah, 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 you go to report to your teacher about how great everything is. They're like, yeah, yeah, okay, okay. And then you come and like, oh, this is just terrible. And then I'll say, oh, good, now you're getting somewhere. So it's sort of like that, actually recognizing these things, you know, really seeing our suffering and investigating it, you know, seeing the out of controlness, the impermanence, all of this kind of stuff, then isn't really fun stuff to see. Actually, it's really good practice. So thank you for bringing that up.
Thanks.
Let's see. Anybody online that might have a comment or question? Doesn't look like it. Anybody else in the room?
Actually, Jordan has her hand up.
Oh, yes, Jordan has his virtual hand raised. Okay, wonderful.
I was going to ask, what was the name of the Philip Moffat book you mentioned in your talk?
Oh, Dancing with Life.
Thank you.
Dancing with Life, yeah. It's very, very good. I really recommend it. And it's very readable and accessible, too. Yes, Suze.
Thanks, Lyndall. On Sunday, when you were talking about this, you also said, and it really had an impact on me, that as we start looking at the Eightfold Path, it's also an opportunity to look back at the first, especially the first two noble truths, and bring some of the wisdom and understanding that we get from the Eightfold Path and take it back. And what really struck me is, as we've been talking about this the whole year, how much clinging I've been denying. You know, it's really had me look back at the second noble truth of where my suffering really comes from. And sometimes I use different words. Clinging is not one of the words I use, but I'll bring things like, wow, I really need this. You know, just this huge emotional investment in it. And I was wondering if you could talk some about, because you brought it up on Sunday and thought it was really helpful, just how going back to the first three noble truths is also, it's not like we're done with those.
No,
and now
no.
We can go to wise view.
No. We're definitely not done with those. I mean, they're those three all of the time. Well, wise view is understanding those. So all of the time, everything we're doing with all of the rest of the Eightfold Path, it's all really, it's directed toward understanding and getting that wise view. So anytime, you know, when we notice our mind states, like Sis was talking about, you know, notice some mind state where, whoa, I'm really attached to this. I'm really identified with this. I'm really miserable because of this. We're investigating really kind of both of those first two noble truths. And what we see in our meditation practice, we're investigating those noble truths. When we work with any of the hindrances, we're investigating those noble truths, you know. The first, the second, the third, when we actually maybe let go of getting, say if we're all caught up in our anger or something like that, or aversion, and then we're actually able to bring mindfulness and bring some space, and the relief we get, we're seeing the third. So, yeah, I mean, we're working with those first three all the time as we're working with our conduct, with our meditation practice, with our actions in our lives. So, yeah, they'd never go away. If we truly understood those three, then the Eightfold Path, we would also have truly understood and perfected it. So it goes hand in hand. Well, thank you for bringing that up. That's a nice way of thinking about it, remembering that, yeah. Let's see. Maybe time for, if anybody else has any more comments or questions, maybe time for maybe one more, and then we can it looks pretty quiet here. So maybe a good thing would be to finish with taking a little, before we do our end and rides and stuff, taking a few moments to sit together and share the merit of our practice tonight. Remembering that when we come together, to sit together, to study the Dharma together, it really creates a force for good that we can feel, that we share with each other, and that can touch others in ways that we might not understand, and that we can share with others in ways that we might understand. So if you have a special person you would like to share with, you know, you can bring that person to mind.
And may these people that we have in our minds share in the merit of our practice today. May they be peaceful, happy, find ease, and find liberation. And then extending that to all beings, everywhere, if we can. May we all share in the merit of this practice. Find happiness, find peace, live with ease, and be liberated.